spokesperson for the Trey Arrow Legal Defense Committee. Trey Arrow is a 31-year-old Florida-born American. Participated in lots of great peaceful nonviolent actions. He is seeking a refugee status here in Canada. We are currently going across the country talking about his case.
Today I bring you greetings and respects from the larger Trey Arrow Collective. I think we would be ignorant to think that the media, whether that be television, print media, news, magazines, books, we'd be ignorant to think that they don't control our society or set trends. It'd be ignorant for us to think that those elements, those mass media forms, help set trends and culture in our society. Have a media like these national papers, the Globe and Mail, the Portland Tribune, and CNN, stating fact that Trey Arrow is an eco-terrorist before being convicted. You see the level of intensity that the media, the FBI, and these PR groups are interested or able to set to convict a peaceful, nonviolent activist.
Activists have been fighting for equality and justice throughout history. Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, Gandhi, just to name a few, have been criticized for their beliefs and for questioning the status quo. They have been assaulted, put in prison, and threatened with their lives. However, their legacies and their struggle for equality have inspired millions and still continue to this day. The torch has been passed on from one generation of activists to another. Michael Scorpitti, also known as Trey Arrow, is an environmentalist and activist from the States who has been incarcerated in British Columbia since March 13, 2004. He is currently being imprisoned at the North Fraser Pretrial Center in British Columbia while awaiting a possible extradition to the United States. Trey came to Canada hoping to escape prosecution in the United States. This became Trey's only option when his life in Portland, Oregon was unjustly turned upside down in the summer of 2002. After working tirelessly for years to protect some of the only ancient forests left in the northwestern US, Trey had become an extremely well-known and important organizer. Like other peaceful organizers, Trey found himself at the forefront of an environmental movement which successfully interfered with industrial powers. He, therefore, became a target. In this second part of a two-part radio documentary, you will hear about the nationwide Trey Arrow speaking tour organized by Ben Shannon and Myna Marr that was held in Winnipeg on January 20th and 21st, 2005. We are going to examine the role of the media and also talk to Trey himself, who is currently being held in the North Fraser Pretrial Center in British Columbia, and who will talk to us about the way he's being treated in prison. Ben Shannon talked at the speaking tour about the media's influence in Trey's case, about propagandists, and the organization Stop Eco-Violence, and its creator, Ron Arnold.
I think it's important to recognize that Trey has not been in a courtroom for 1 minute to face indictment, to face charges, or to face a fair trial. Although, in the corporate media, Globe and Mail, the Portland Tribune, and even in CNN, you hear the words eco-terrorist Trey Arrow. It's similar to hearing the words convicted individual X, blah, blah, blah. It's interesting how the media feels it's in its ability that they have enough evidence in their eyes to convict an individual who's never even had a trial nor faced indictment, never been in a courtroom for 1 minute. Though the media, under the pressure and the direction of PR groups like Stop Eco-Violence, are being pressured to use the word eco-terrorist and to not use the word alleged or suspected or accused. They are being pressured by these groups, Stop Eco-Violence and its creator, Ron Arnold, to press the full use of the word eco-terrorist, to state fact that Trey Arrow is an eco-terrorist. These headlines are similar to the headlines of somebody who's already been convicted of a crime. Murderer John X, bank robber, Alyssa, why? Eco-terrorist Trey Arrow is an example of how the media is convicting this individual before he receives a fair trial. How that really affects Trey is the fact that he won't receive a fair trial in the United States. The extent that these PR groups, like Stop Eco-Violence and Ron Arnold, have gone to continuously spread the message of an eco-terrorist and have continued to sell media by branding Trey as an eco-terrorist means that almost no single individual, and especially no 12 jurors in Portland, Oregon, are going to be able to sit in front of a judge and say they have not ever heard about Trey Arrow or his case, because every Portland paper refuses to print the word accused. They state eco-terrorist Trey Arrow. They're convicting him in the media's eyes or in the public's eyes by using those terms. I think we would be ignorant to think that the media, whether that be television, print media, news, magazines, books, we'd be ignorant to think that they don't control our society or set trends. It'd be ignorant for us to think that those elements, those mass media forms, help set trends and culture in our society. Have a media like these national papers, the Globe and Mail, the Portland Tribune, and CNN, stating fact that Trey Arrow is an eco-terrorist before being convicted. You see the level of intensity that the media, the FBI, and these PR groups are interested or able to set to convict a peaceful, nonviolent activist. The state implemented its most effective tactic on Trey Arrow. It also implemented its effective tactic on numerous other revolutionary activists and people in the community, from Martin Luther King to Jaggi Singh in Quebec, Montreal, Huey P. Newton of the Black Panther Party, Nelson Mandela. The tactic of setting an individual up, making them look like something they're not, giving them a jacket, labeling them snitch, narc, terrorist, violent. They implemented the most effective tactic known to any state, from the Roman Empire to this state, and that's the tactic of divide and conquer. To take a movement, an environmental movement, peasant movement during the Roman Empire, take it, cut it in half. Call one half terrorists, violent, thugs, commies, whatever the slingo is going to work. Take the other half, call them pacifists, anarchists, socialists, whatever you want to call them. Make them butt heads, and all of a sudden you step back and you see them destroy each other. That is the most effective tactic the state has. They've taken that tactic and implemented it in Trey Arrow's case. How? They're calling him an eco-terrorist. We're in communication with environmental groups in BC and in Portland. Those organizations, when we call them, don't want anything to do with Trey. We ask them why. In the nicest way possible, we're like, Trey is a peaceful, nonviolent activist, like you. Like you, Betty, or like you, John. You've been out sitting in front of logging trucks, refusing to let a logging truck go in and rape the forest, destroy all the trees. You got arrested that day. The same thing happened to Trey. It could be you. The response? But we don't agree with his tactics. We think burning down logging vehicles is wrong. I pull the phone back and I'm like, oh, they won. The state did it. Oh, crap. They implemented the most effective tactic. They've taken the environmental movement, cut it in half, called Trey an eco-terrorist, took all the other environmental activists, his allies, and made them believe he's guilty. They spread eco-terrorists so much in the media that non-violent, peaceful activists like Trey Arrow out in BC now think he's an eco-terrorist because of all the media's work to convict him in their eyes. Because the FBI is contacting these organizations saying, hey, if Trey Arrow supporters come around, make sure you be careful because they're terrorists. Like, they're violent people. They blow up logging trucks and everything. We've got all this evidence, mass pile of evidence that he committed these crimes. The evidence, of course, is the sworn testimony of a convicted felon, an arsonist, Jacob Sherman. You'd think there'd be, like, fingerprint evidence, maybe some gasoline at Trey's house, videotape evidence, maybe. Oh, maybe the Trey Arrow's confession that he did the crimes. No, there's nothing but the testimony of Jacob Sherman, a convicted arsonist, who after an intense FBI interrogation, and the partner 6 months pregnant, knowing Jeffrey Freeluers did 22 and a half years, or got sentenced for 22 and a half years, and doing 22 and a half years, figures the only way he can save his butt is by giving what the FBI wants. Say Trey Arrow was a mastermind, we'll give you 4 years. He received 4 years for his first crime. Jeffrey received 22 and a half years. The difference there is staggering. Jacob Sherman burned 5 logging vehicles, worth way more than 3 SUVs. He was served a lot less sentence. Why did he receive a plea bargain? course, we'll never know. The FBI isn't going to go out and tell the truth anytime soon. What this all leads back to, and I've gone on a few different tangents, hopefully touching on a few issues, trying to sum up the fact that one, Trey Arrow's history as a nonviolent activist, as a peaceful activist, is clear. His dedication to not wanting to hurt anybody, though the legend said. The tactics of the state and the media's role in that to divide and conquer the environmental movement is clear. It is clear to me, when we go to talks in Fredericton and another environmentalist, the same groups in BC, environmentalists in New Brunswick, going, well, we don't agree with his tactics. One lady said to me at a talk one night, talk in Fredericton, the same statement, we don't agree with his tactics. And I was like, I'm sorry, I forgot you were there that night. You were hanging with Jacob Sherman, you saw Trey Arrow there. Because he's never received a trial. He has almost no evidence against him except the testimony of Jacob Sherman, but you've convicted him. And you've fell into the trap that the state has implemented. Why would the state implement this tactic? The question we all have to ask ourselves. It's because Trey Arrow is an effective activist. He's worked behind the scenes to save Eagle Creek. His work and talk with the legend of Eagle Creek, and his work and examples of how different ways you can be effective. From running for Congress, spreading the message, from sitting in a tree and refusing to come down to risk your own life, send the message. How does the media come into this role more? As I mentioned, these PR groups, Stop Eco Violence. They are organizations, they are lobby groups, groups who are funded not by the government, not by independent organizations. Groups like Stop Eco Violence and its head, Ron Arnold, are sponsored by logging companies, by companies that build logging equipment, by companies who build logging roads, by companies who destroy the earth. Groups like Stop Eco Violence produce reports, articles, press releases. Stop Eco Violence and its creator, Ron Arnold, is a propaganda organization. They're propagandists. They spread the information they want to spread. And their information, since it's funded by multinational logging companies, isn't pro-environmentalist. Logging companies aren't caring very much about the environment. If they were, we wouldn't have such a large movement to save the environment, because it wouldn't need to be saved, because we wouldn't be destroying it. Stop Eco Violence, Ron Arnold, $1 million budgets come from these groups, these logging companies. They send out reports as a live group, media press releases and reports to the media, the corporate media outlets. As propagandists, they're trained and they've achieved a level of, I would say sneakiness, but a level where they can get into these corporate media outlets. They can get in there because they dress like them, they act like them, they talk like them, they have the same degree as them, but they work in a private industry. They write press releases that are attractive to the writers and editors of these media outlets. They know what to do, they wine and dine, they smooze and cruise these outlets because that's what their profession is. The propagandists, that's what they do. Ron Arnold is named for coining the term eco-terrorist. That is his term. If it could have a little C beside it, a little copyright, it would be Ron Arnold. He's a propagandist. He works for these logging companies very directly. The link isn't like some Swedish company, bank in Cuba, and Mexico, and the money gets funded around, you never know where it comes from. It's very obvious. Stop Eco Violence, the organization, is funded and run by logging companies. Ron Arnold is coined, his name for coining the term eco-terrorist, and those PR press releases and those lobby, or those reports have in them the continuing pressure for media outlets to call Trey Arrow an eco-terrorist. Here are all the great facts. These are Trey Arrow's great facts. You see them? They're all bogus. They're all made-up lies. They're all propaganda. And they all say eco-terrorist is fact. It's not uncommon to see corporate media just use whatever sources they get coming in, not cross-check them, prove them, just regurgitate them, and send them back out. Stop Eco Violence is a multi-million dollar organization which is credible in the eyes of the media because of that, because of the professional, they're a professional organization, thus their information is credible, thus we can print it, thus it's done. The maximum sentence for the crimes he's being convicted of, which is basically fires, arson, is 80 years. Jeffrey received 22 and a half. Trey Arrow is going to set a new precedent. When Jeffrey was sentenced 4 years ago, it set a precedent. 22 and a half years was mind-blowing. It stunned people. He was guilty of the crime. He's admitted to the crime. He received 22 and a half years. He's bunked beside a murderer who did that crime. The same month he burnt the vehicle, he was doing 7 to 10. That shows the exact idea that the sentencing structure in the United States have. Murder, 7 to 10. political arson, 22 and a half. Trey Arrow will do more than 22 and a half years if convicted in the United States.
Trey himself gave an interview to CKUW on March 18, 2005, from the North Fraser Pre-Trial Center in British Columbia, and talked about the way he is treated by the inmates and the guards, about his beliefs and his diet.
Yeah, the states right now, like, I've been locked up over a year. It's been on the 13th of March, it marked a year of incarceration. This is the first time I've ever been locked up. I'm not a criminal. Nobody belongs in a jail. Nobody, not even folks that have committed what we consider some serious heinous crimes, like jails, just don't help, in my opinion, for the most part. There are some elements that, it's all about perspective, really, and it's all about taking advantage of what we do have and, you know, turning the darkness into the light no matter where we are and what situation we're in. So I have been blessed to be able to, been given the strength and the guidance by the spirit world to be able to, you know, turn this situation into the most positive that I can. And again, you know, I've never been locked up before. I have been arrested before for civil disobedience, but, you know, nothing major. And, even when I was found guilty, it was basically community service. There was no jail time. And so it's definitely been a very, very challenging time in here for the last over a year now. And it's, basically, there's two huge elements here. There's the staff, and then there's the inmates. And at any given time, I can be harassed, assaulted, intimidated, or treated fairly well by either or both of those groups. So when the inmates are giving me problems and the staff are giving me problems, it's basically all I can do to just stay alive in here, literally. I've been assaulted many times. I'm an easy target for many reasons. Assaulted by inmates, that is. The staff, they can basically get away with assaulting. There was one incident that the staff person assaulted me, but nothing really, they really can't do anything. I don't know if I could do anything about that, but I'm an easy target because I walk a path of nonviolence. I am a total anomaly, even on the outside, but especially in here, because, you know, I eat only raw vegan food. I'm the only one that eats this way in this whole entire institution. I don't watch TV. Things that I do and don't do make me a very easy target. I try to be kind and generous, and so most of these things are seen as a weakness in a lot of the mentality from the inmates. So I'm basically, like I said, have been, you know, prey to these folk that, you know, don't necessarily have my interest in mind. And the staff is pretty tough at times. It's funny because I try not to judge anybody and try not to make any generalizations. You know, there's some people in the police force that are generally want to help and, you know, are somewhat bound by and restricted by the system and their training and such. And it's the same thing in here. I can see some of the staff people, they totally get an ego boost and trying to fill some wounds of maybe being picked on or bullied as a young person and really take it out on us. And then there's other people here that, you know, genuinely care and don't treat us like complete scum and are, you know, really treat us kindly and look at it as just a job and maybe trying to, you know, make things a little bit better for us in here. So it kind of the whole spectrum is, you know, some of the inmates I've had amazing conversations with and great times with, and other inmates, like I said, have, you know, been very hostile. And same thing with the staff. One of the biggest issues and the biggest hardships is the food. As you may or may not know, and for those that might be listening to this, just a little bit of a background. Once I was arrested on March 13th, 2004, I began a hunger strike to protest many things, the way that the justice system treats me and others, and the framing by the FBI, and also as a token of solidarity to all the beings that are suffering at the expense of corporate agendas, which you know, which affect and oppress every living thing, not just humans, but all beings. And I continued that hunger strike for 44 days, going into April, and broke the hunger strike after the 44th day, and basically told the administration here the type of food that I needed. I actually told them when I arrived here, but I was fasting at the time, so I didn't pursue the issue too much. But when I broke the fast, I told them, look, I eat only raw food, I eat only vegan food, I need fruits and veggies and some nuts and seeds, and that's it, that's all I need, that's all I want, I can't eat anything else. for medical reasons, for religious, spiritual reasons, and they refuse to honor that, even though they basically, by law, they are supposed to honor religious diets. Because mine is somewhat rare and not as mainstream as, say, a vegan Buddhist, or even like a vegetarian, or certain Christian restrictions or guidelines, because I follow a combination of the Essene path, which incorporates the raw food, and the Buddhist path, which incorporates the vegan food. It's not as common, it's not as well known, and they refuse to honor it. When one eats raw food for a long period of time, it basically becomes a medical condition as well, that putting cooked food in the body would cause great harm and great illness. And so they refuse to honor my diet for those reasons as well. So for both grounds, medical and spiritual, they refuse to honor it. So they basically put me on a vegetarian diet, which isn't even close to what I need and what I consume, because it not only was it not vegan, it still, you know, still contained lots of animal products, but it was mostly cooked. And so I was forced to trade away all my cooked meals with the other guys here that eat all the cooked food, and to try to get a little bit of fruits and veggies that come, but they don't come every meal, and sometimes they don't even come for a whole day. And literally, according to the menu, there's a 4-week menu here. There sometimes would be 2 or 3 days that would go by where not one piece of fresh food would come at breakfast, lunch, or dinner. No fruits, no veggies. So after the 44 days, I had lost, you know, some weight and some mass and some muscle and fat, and over the next 3 months, I continued to waste away because I was getting so little food that I could eat. And in August, I basically almost died of starvation. I got down to 80 pounds, and they finally put me in the hospital and allowed me to have the food that I needed. My support crew and the doctors allowed me to have the food, and the administration here allowed my support crew, my family, to make it and bring it to me. Lots of guacamole with avocados, and lots of smoothies with lots of fresh fruit, all live, raw, vegan food. And, you know, and I immediately regained my strength and my health and nourishment, and the doctors refused to release me until the administration here finally honored my diet. So since then, they have been honoring my diet, and I have been getting raw food every meal, which is definitely a blessing, and definitely, been able to have them make some concessions and honor my diet. Part of the problem, though, is that it's an ongoing struggle to be able to keep my food because, again, it's all raw food, and most of the time, especially the fruits, it comes unripe. It comes hard and green, and no body is designed to consume food that's not ripe. And so the policy here is that they don't allow anybody to keep any food in their room, or no perishable food, that is. They allow, you know, and of course, if you want to eat dead cooked stuff, you can have it in your cell, like, for example, like a box of rice and, you know, bunch of like processed ramen noodles that, you know, are riddled with animal products and MSG and stuff. You can have those things, but you can't have anything fresh. And so what happens is I try to keep it in my cell to let it ripen. I don't eat it the exact moment or day or time that I get it, and they end up coming into my cell and deeming it either in excess or overripe and taking it from me. So it's a constant struggle to be able to eat the food that I am given, and so that's definitely a bit of an issue. The food's definitely the biggest issue. I am grateful that I can get a little bit of fresh air. This is a remand center here, so it's not, the programs are slashed, all the funding's been slashed by our, you know, thanks to the wonderful Liberal Premier Campbell, and so a lot of the things that typically are provided to inmates are not available here. At a sentence center, even though none of us have been convicted of anything here, it's the whole mentality of innocent until proven guilty is just completely eradicated, and it's complete opposite here. It's guilty until proven innocent. And even places where people have been convicted and have been sentenced have far more freedom and far more programs and other things available to them. So here it's very restricted. I'm locked up in a 24-hour period. I'm locked up in my cell about three-quarters of that time, and out only sporadically throughout the day, from 8 a.m. till 8 p.m., and even less than that on the weekends, because it's all business here. It's all runs about money. So on the weekends, everything shuts down. You know, the administration shuts down, and they let us, they get us out even later on the weekends. And the availability of grass and any kind of natural earth mother exposure is completely non-existent here. At least I do get to go into a little court area. It's very, very small, but at least the ceiling is, at least it's not enclosed at the top, and so I can see the sun and the grandmother moon, and I can get a bit of fresh air, so I'm grateful for that. But again, even at Wilkinson, where I was initially held for the first month and a half of my incarceration, there was a huge, huge area. I could get my feet in the grass, I could do yoga in the grass, and I could clearly see grandmother moon and grandfather sun and could see some trees and stuff. And the window even opened, there was like a little bit of able to get fresh air in my cell, which is not available here. At North Fraser, where I am currently, the windows, most of the windows have tint on them, and they're very, very small windows, and they don't open, so I can't get any fresh air in my cell. I can barely get any natural light because of this tint on the windows, so it's definitely a very oppressive environment for sure. Like I said, though, earlier, you know, I do try to make the best of it, and I have a very strong connection to the natural world and to the spirit world, and without any real dogmatic affiliation with any organized religion, I know that there's a great spirit that moves through all things, you know, and many, many traditions throughout the world call it a different name. I choose to not use the word God. It's, you know, I sometimes say goddess or great spirit or, you know, the divine, whatever word one wants to insert, you know. I do feel that this is the spirit that moves through all things, that gives life to all of the flora and fauna, and keeps all of the magic going on within the universe and the planetary elements, grandfather sun and grandmother moon. And I feel, you know, grateful to be able to, you know, have some time to do some prayer and meditation and connect with these natural elements, even though I can't directly or entirely be connected to them. And, you know, it does offer a chance for, you know, lots of introspection and lots of time to, you know, heal the wounds and heal all the crap that we've been bombarded by, that I've been bombarded by my whole life, you know, the system and the corruption within all of these organized institutions, and try to, you know, rise above it and, you know, pray for peace and pray that, you know, that all the people that are committing oppressive actions are, you know, that they awaken to their divine potential, because, you know, this oppression that is so ubiquitous, that is affecting all living things, is so unnecessary, and inherently, you know, most people don't mean harm, and a lot of the harm that is created is created by the system and the structure and the culture that we're embedded in. A lot of folks don't even realize how impactful their actions are. So, you know, I spend my time listening to music. I am able to get a few music stations through the speaker that comes in the wall myself, so I'm grateful for that, and spend some time on the phone, like doing interviews and talking to my amazing family and support crew all over the world, really, and getting a little fresh air and having some visits. I am allowed visits, and so those are some of the things that occupy my time. And as far as my case goes, you know, right now I'm being held I have no charges in Canada. I did have a couple minor charges that were dealt with back in September, and I have no current charges in Canada. I'm being held for these alleged charges in the States, which are, you know, they are related to two incidents of arson, and they are strictly property damage. You know, I have been emphatically, you know, declaring my innocence to these, that the FBI is framing me and trying to rope me into these arsons, and even though it's strictly property damage and not one living thing was hurt, I have 17 different counts stemming from these two incidences, and they are basically trying to lock me up for the rest of my life, for more than my life. There's a few charges that, if I'm convicted on, the minimum sentence is life, just for a couple of those. So the thing is that, so I'm being held basically illegally, unjustly, for charges that I haven't been convicted of, that there is no evidence except people saying that I was involved. It's completely hearsay. And they've pled guilty. Three people pled guilty and implicated me for a hugely reduced sentence. They were facing a possible of 80 years, and they received less than 4 years to basically cooperate with the government and implicate me. And now they're trying to label me as not only the T word, but also as a ringleader, and that I brainwashed these people into doing these things. And that, you know, and now they're trying to silence me. They're trying to lock me up for the rest of my life. And they do this. This is what the government, the FBI, does to any group or activist that challenges the status quo, that they view as subversive because they, you know, are hurting the economic agenda of the corporations. And, you know, everyone from Mumia Abu-Jamal to Fred Hampton to Judy Berry to Leonard Peltier and countless others have been literally attacked, murdered, framed, and not because they're guilty of these things. that they're accused of or convicted of, but they're because they've stood their ground and tried to bring about some positive change for the planet, for non-human animals, and for indigenous people and people of non-white origin. And that's basically what the FBI does. It's part of their entire agenda. And so I'm next on their list because I have been involved with effective campaigns. I've made a name for myself. I've received international attention for doing a ledge sit that was back in 2000. I climbed a building with Forest Service, and I lived on a 9-inch ledge for 11 days protesting the sale of Eagle Creek, which is an area in Oregon, and challenging this, you know, exposing the lies and the corruption within the government and the corporations. And that particular sale, Eagle Creek, that I was involved with helping to protest, it was basically a decade-long struggle, and many organizations and people were involved, and eventually culminated 2 years after the ledge sit, a little less than 2 years after the ledge sit, resulted in canceling the sale. So basically they view me as a threat to their agenda, and they want to try to stop me, and either that's, you know, murdering me or locking me up for the rest of my life, you know. And so that's basically where it stands. I am facing extradition. I have an extradition hearing set in April, but it's probably going to be pushed back. I won't have that confirmed until next week.
In the latest update, a new extradition hearing date was set. On Wednesday, March 23rd, 2005, the judge in Trey's extradition hearing approved a delay in Trey's hearing. The new hearing, set for June 27th, 2005, will happen in Vancouver, British Columbia. This hearing will last for at least 3 days, and it will decide whether Trey will be extradited to the United States. If the judge believes that Trey's human rights will be violated or that he will not receive a fair trial, the judge has the right to refuse Trey's extradition. However, if the judge refuses to extradite Trey for human rights violations, it would severely damage U.S.-Canada relations. Therefore, this case is no longer about one man's rights, but about maintaining the economic relationship with the controlling forces to ourselves. If you would like to know more about this case, visit Trey's website at www.treyarrow.org.
I think there are two different things individuals listening to this presentation or this interview could do to help. One is educate yourself on the ability, the message, the meaning, the biasness of corporate media. Do not buy into what corporate media believes and says. I, of course, don't suggest that everything they say is a false lie, but I think they regurgitate, they source, and they fuel anger and falseness and untruth about situations. The war in Iraq, the continuous exploitation of any sort of word, T-word, terrorism, communism, McCarthy era, sells headlines. And that's what they're there for. If we had a totally non-profit media in our country and in every other country, you wouldn't see this, but our media sells itself and it profits from itself and it wants to sell. And the story of Little Jimmy's dog doesn't sell, but the story of the eco-terrorist, the story that catches the attention of people at home, does sell. Educate yourself on the media. Understand that corporate media, Global News, CBC even, and the National Post, Globe and Mail, these institutions, these outlets aren't unbiased. They are very biased. They have a very set agenda. Educate yourself on that. The second thing you do is just read up, educate yourself on the situation of political prisoner Trey Arrow and other political prisoners who are fighting injustice and who are resisting the status quo. Educate yourself. Go to treyarrow.org, his website. Find out more about Trey. Write Trey a letter. You can imagine being in jail, knowing that the FBI, the biggest organization in the world, is going to be spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to try to get you back to the United States and make you spend the rest of your life in prison. It's quite hard, saddening, frustrating. So write Trey a letter. You can find his snail mail address on the website, www.treyarrow.org. You can also donate money to the cause. You can donate money to his legal defense so we can try to give Trey as best of a fair trial that we can give him in the United States. I think it's really important that all communities from Winnipeg, Thunder Bay, Vancouver, Halifax, continue to organize, continue to educate, continue to think about our society and our our values in our society, think about that and understand that media and our society need to adapt to change to a better society and to create a society which people benefit over profit, and profit does not benefit over people.
This has been the second part of a two-part radio documentary on the political prisoner Trey Arrow. My name is Bojan Dulabic, and you are listening to CKUW's The Beat, 95.9 FM.